But I was very fortunate in that although I had burns to the entire area of my face, my hands, some burns on my legs, and they were first, second, and some third degree burns. But I was just very, very lucky in that the surgeon that worked on me, as soon as I got to the main hospital in Caserta in Italy, it's a Canadian hospital, was a fellow by the name of Major Moore, who had been consulting surgeon on burns at Royal Victoria Hospital in Montreal prior to the war, and was probably one of the top burn surgeons in the world at that time. So he treated me completely different to the way they had treated burns up until that time.
And
mainly because they used to wrap burns and leave them wrapped until they healed. Sometimes that they would put maggots in out of the dressings to eat the flesh, to keep the flesh clear. The type of treatment they gave resulted in an awful lot of infection and an awful lot of scar tissue. They used tannic acid and tannic jellies and caused a lot of scar tissue. Major Moore believed that in order to heal burns, the healing of burns used a lot of blood, and the shock used a lot of blood. So he gave the patient transfusions of plasma for quite some time, and keeping the blood supply up. But it was just a matter of keeping them absolutely clean and no infection. So he kept wet dressings on the patient all the time, and used pretty well just a saline solution. But I know that for weeks, or for a long time anyway, my dressings were completely changed every 4 hours, and it took the nurses 2 hours to change the dressing. So that, but they were always moist, so nothing ever stuck. But he really believed in keeping infection out. And I don't know what else he did, but he was a damn good surgeon. And he told me right at the time that he was quite sure that he would eliminate scars entirely from my face except on my upper lip. And he said the hair follicles are there, so if you grow a mustache, nobody will ever see them. But eventually they disappear too. The only scars I really have are on my wrists and a little bit on my legs. But it's after 44 years, it's really hard to see them. But see, that's all scar tissue. The tendons were burning in there. It was deep enough, and that's where I had a wide wrist strap on at the time. And that scar tissue. But these nails were all burnt off, this hand and this hand. But so I'm lucky I've hardly got a scar at all.
How long did it take, healing process?
That was May that we were in. I guess I was in a hospital. In the hospital maybe about 6 weeks, and then I had a convalescent leave after that. When I was supposed to be shipped out of Italy on a hospital ship to go back to England, because anybody that was going to be out of action for 6 weeks, they didn't like to keep in a theater of war. They moved them to bases in England. And but Major Moore came to me just the day before I was supposed to be booked out in the hospital ship, and said that he really thought that with my treatment, his treatment was coming along beautifully, and they had other injured people that he couldn't help, but he thought he could do more for me than anybody in England. And I said, I believe you, you can. And he said, well, he said, if you'd like to stay, I'll change it and you stay here. And so everything went except me, all my papers, all my documents, and I didn't get a letter then for, I don't know, 5 or 6 months catching up with me. But he did, he sent me to an excellent convalescent home in, British Red Cross home in Sorrento, which is south of Naples. And after another month there, I was in shape to go back to the regiment. Well, to go back to the regiment, but then I went to a holding camp.
The BCDs were
out of action at the time, so I went to a holding camp in Avellino, and after I was only there about 4 or 5 days, and there were 3 or 4 officers there that had been down for various reasons, injuries or sickness, and were on the way back up. And there were about 100 young lieutenants in from Canada. And the CO called us up one day, and the three of us, and said, you know, you fellas can wait for your own regiment to go up. They're out of action right now. They don't need you. But we have a demand in from the 1st Army Tank Brigade for a few officers immediately. And if you'd, he said, really, we have to send the other odd 100 officers up first, but they haven't even seen a Sherman tank. I'd like to hold them back to go some training. So he was looking for volunteers. So I said immediately, well, I'll volunteer to go up if I can choose my regiment. And at that time, you see, the 1st Army Tank Brigade was the Calgary Regiment, the Ontarios, and the Three Rivers. So I chose to go to the Calgary's, and as soon as I said that, it only took about another friend of mine, too, by the name of Lieutenant Mundy, came up with me to the Calgary's. But it only took them about 3 minutes to get us a Jeep, and we drove right up to the front line in the Jeep, and joined the Calgary south of the Arno River, south of Florence.
They were happy to get you. You put them up back up over 50%.
Right.
Didn't you say you were saying that you put them back up to over 50%?
Oh, yes, I said that before. When I met the colonel, Stoney Richardson, and the Major Bill Ritchie, who was the 2IC, as soon as the colonel asked me where I was from, and I said Edmonton, he said, ah, Ritchie, we finally got you. He said, now we're finally 50% Westerner again in the officers in the regiment, because during a war it changed so much east to west. So that's when things were a little different. I won't say I changed my vocation, but I got involved in something that was entirely different, because Colonel Richardson asked me what I wanted to do. And I said, well, sir, I've had experience commanding a troop of Shermans, and I would like to take over a Sherman tank troop for you. He said, well, Coppinger, what do you know about recce? I said, I don't know the first thing about recce, sir. He said, well, I'll tell you one thing about recce. It'll either win you an MC or a graveyard. And I said, sir, I'm not the slightest bit interested in either the one or the other. He said, that's the answer I want you to take command of the recce troop. So anyway, the recce troop then was quite a lot larger, because that's 11 tanks and 44 men in the reconnaissance troop. Quite a lot larger than 3 and 15. And but it was... really excellent. I enjoyed all of my time with the Calgary's. From joining them in the south of the Arno, I was with them all the rest of the time in Italy. And I was, because the reconnaissance troop is supposed to have a captain in charge, and I was a lieutenant, so I was an acting captain for quite some time while I commanded the recce troop. But unfortunately, as the war drew to a close, there were so many captains that were coming back from brigade and out of hospital, my rank was never confirmed. So I was discharged as a lieutenant.
How does a recce tank troop work within the rest of the regiment?
Basically, a reconnaissance. Reconnaissance is, if they're used correctly, they should not get into action. They're really just entitled, supposed to feel out the enemy, find out where it is, and get out of the way, because you haven't got anything that you can fight with.
You had the small guns still at this time?
Well, basically, by that time, we had, in the Calgary's, we had cut the turrets off the tanks, because the guns were useless, the pop guns, and then you just had machine guns on the front of them, and you used them for a lot of different things, but without a turret on, of course, they were hard to see. But we did a fair amount of reconnaissance on foot, you know, rather than with the tanks, to find out what was going on. One of the major foot reconnaissance, I went up with another officer from north of Marathi. We were in the Apennine Mountains at the time at Marathi. We spent a whole winter in the Apennine Mountains. And it was a very difficult terrain for tanks, but we did a number of foot reconnaissances while we were in that area. Then, of course, in the early in early 45, after spending a short time, the regiment spent a short time on the Adriatic coast, as well as, say, Florence and Marradi was almost up the middle. Then we went over to the Adriatic coast for a period. We thought we were going to go into Greece, but we didn't cross there to go to Greece. And at that time, you know, Churchill was interested in going out through the soft underbelly of Europe, but that wasn't Roosevelt's idea, or not Roosevelt, but the American commanders. They wanted to go into France a little bit more. So we then went to the back to the other side and went to we sailed from Leghorn in Italy, which is not too far from Pisa, I guess. And from Leghorn, we sailed to Marseille. And that was a very, very interesting and eventful trip, because all of our regiment had been loaded on landing ship tanks. One thing that was amusing just before leaving, in the Calgarys we had piles of extra vehicles, well beyond what you're supposed to have, extra jeeps, extra trucks.
How did this happen? Rare?
No, we were, I shouldn't say that this really, but some troops, when they retreated, the jeeps wouldn't go fast enough, so that they, if they ran out of gas, they'd be left on the field, and we just picked them up, put gas in them. We had lots of extra jeeps. We had them all painted with our numbers and our regimental insignia, but unfortunately, when we left Italy, there was only enough room on the ships for the standard complement of vehicles, so we had to just get rid of them all, leave them there. And my troop of recce troops were the last to board, and I didn't board a landing ship tank with the rest of the regiment. My 11 tanks were on with a bunch of British tanks. I don't know which regiment it was, but a bunch of British tanks. And we were just one day out, and we ran into a terrible Mediterranean storm. And Mediterranean storms can be wild, you know, like Great Lakes storms. And during the storm, the ship lost its port side propeller, so we were really almost floundering around. It was an American crew. There were two crews on board, and they didn't know where they were. They were lost. I know I was in the two navigators were arguing with each other, the new crew, the relieving crew, and the old crew, as to where they were, but they didn't know. And the captain had us all one night, or most one night, up on a deck prepared to abandon ship with life jackets on. It was a touchy situation. Plus the fact, not my smaller tanks, but some of the big tanks broke loose in a hold, which is a very dangerous thing. They're chained down, you see, and they broke loose in a hold, and they were banging about. But we did get to Marseille. And in Marseille, the rest of my regiment had gone. When I disembarked, I was in sort of a shipyard and a naval yard, and I found out that they had been loaded on flat cars and had moved up through France on the way to see Belgium, and Holland hadn't been taken then, but most of France had been. And after about a week of scrounging around in Marseille, I was finally able to get a few flat cars and a train heading in the right direction, and loaded my troops onto flat cars. And we met up with our regiment about 10 days after they got there in a town called Dottenies in Belgium. So from Dottenies it was...
Had Belgium been taken?
Not... most of Belgium is taken. Holland, there were still troops, pockets of troops all along of enemy troops all along the Atlantic Wall. They had been circled, you might say, but there were still pockets. And after a short leave in Belgium, while we were in Belgium and the regiment was on leave, I was sent on as they wanted somebody to learn more about the mines that were being used in Europe that were different to some of the mines that we had known and used and we were familiar with in Holland. So I was sent on a British mine school in Ostend-sur-Mer. So I was up there for a couple of weeks. That was good training. They spent 1 week of the course. They showed you all of the types of booby traps and anti-personnel mines that they had found and how to disarm tank mines, etc. And then the second week you cleared part of the areas that hadn't been cleared before for training. So it was interesting. Then I went back to Russia.
Is that a difficult area for tanks to operate in? It's a lot of water, the line land, and the Germans had broken the dike, so a lot of the areas were flooded.
I wouldn't say that they had broken the dikes. There were flooded areas, but that was... I don't know of any dikes that the Germans broke. They might have, but they wouldn't break one very easily. They'd have to do a lot of bombing to break a dike. Dikes are pretty big things. The little story about the Dutch boy that held his finger in the dike is not true. When you first see a dike, the dike across the Zuider Zee, for example, is big enough to have a four-lane highway on top of it, and they're big and wide and thick. It wasn't nearly as difficult. Not nearly as difficult as Italy. Italy was a very difficult country for tanks because of the mountains. So it was easier to operate in Holland and Belgium for the most part than it was there. So we were, went into action, I guess, north of Nijmegen for the first time in Europe. And after cleaning out different pockets in the area, we shelled Arnhem. Our tanks were used as artillery, which was quite different. Arnhem had been, the Americans had tried to take it all one whole winter before and hadn't been able to do it, and we were the first troops into it. I think the Ontarios went in first, and then our troop went in after the Ontarios into Arnhem, and there were other places like, I can't remember them all, but it was just skirmishes, and we ended up the war in Holland.
Was it mostly street fighting?
No. Maybe the infantry did a little bit of that. It was just shelling and engaging the enemy, but the enemy by that time were using horse artillery. You know, they didn't have anything left. They were the only thing that put us out is that once the Germans pulled right out, we were ordered to stop. We couldn't go anywhere else because Roosevelt had, I guess, at that time made the deal with Stalin that. They'd wait until the Russians were ready to get into Berlin, and we could have walked in, but we were just stopped.
Is that disappointing to you?
We couldn't understand it. You know, we knew that the enemy wasn't there, and yet we couldn't go forward. At that time, we didn't know why. We didn't know that we were waiting for the Russians to reach Berlin. So it was. But anyway, the war ended, We did a lot of things at the end of the war. We, you know, rounded up lots of prisoners, and we marched a lot of prisoners back to Germany.
How long were you were in Holland at this time?
I guess, see, the war ended in May, and we were in Holland until about October, I guess.
So it's a long time to...
There was lots to do. No, maybe just till September, and then we went to England, and we sailed from Ostend, I believe, for England, and then in England for a month or two before coming home. But as far as I'm concerned, the war was an experience for everyone that was fortunate enough to come back in good shape. I think those that came back in good shape and had some responsibility during their time in Europe gained an awful lot. because there's no other way, Tom, that a young person in his, say, early 20s could have the experience of commanding men, of leading troops in action, of being responsible for men, mainly working with people and knowing how to work with people. It was just excellent training for a lot of us. It did me a lot of good, I know. There's no way of maturing faster than that. So that's about it. That's pretty well the whole war, as far as I was concerned.
I guess you were fairly eager to get out of the army after the war. You didn't want to
stay. Oh, yes.
Had a little trouble getting out.
We got home in December, went on a leave, and then I went back to Calgary, to Mulata Barracks for my discharge, and they told me to report into the barracks that they weren't going to give me a discharge. And I said, look, the war is over. I want a discharge. I have no interest in being in the peacetime army. They said, well, I'm sorry, we're not going to give you a discharge. And I asked why. They said, well, because of your age, you're young, and because of looking at your papers, the amount of training you've had in special training. So we need a certain amount to stay in the army, and you're staying in. I said, well, I'm not interested. And I said, well, you better go on another leave. So this went on back and forth, and I went on about three leaves. And
with pay,
and I was really kind of stupid because I was pushing to get out, and yet they were sending me on leave with pay all the time. But finally, in about my firm, I'm back to work. I went back to work the 1st of January, and this was getting on into March, and the firm were interested and offered me a position in another city, a smaller town outside of Edmonton, and I wanted to move. I was married at the time, and I talked them into a discharge. So they just gave me a discharge to the reserve list of officers at that time. But I finally got completely out of the army. And really, I never went to... I went to the odd reunion up until 1948. That's about 2 years. And I never went to another one until a couple of years ago. And I was at a reunion of the Calgary Tank Regiment since I spoke to you last in June, the end of June, and in Red Deer. Just very, very interesting. Met a lot of fellows, met some fellows that I hadn't seen since Italy, since England.
Is there anything else you'd like to talk about, any topic that we haven't discussed?
I think we've covered pretty well everything.
Okay.